nearby wooded areas in search of chanterelle mushrooms. For our evening meal, Mom would brown the mushrooms in butter with a dash of nutmeg and would serve them with pork roast or other dishes. Dad was completing the Dune screenplay and liked to read it to us in the evenings. Jan and I would sit in deep leather armchairs by a glass-fronted bookcase containing copies of his books, while he sat on a black leather couch, leaning forward over script pages spread across a glass coffee table. Mom sat in her favorite orange naugahyde chair nearby, clicking her knitting needles as she listened to him. Occasionally, she would make comments or offer suggestions. On Sunday mornings, Mom prepared sumptuous breakfasts of blueberry pancakes for us. They were served with real Vermont maple syrup, one of many items my parents purchased by mail order. Located as they were in a rather remote area, they had mail order catalogs from all over the world and were constantly ordering things: kitchen items, seeds, gourmet foods, clothing, and much more. They kept the catalog stacked on a bookshelf and on the bottom shelf of a table, in a reading area just off the kitchen. Mom enjoyed shopping by mail, but Dad was a fanatic about it, to the extent that he would never throw away old catalogs, out of fear he might need them one day. The only time Mom could ever throw away catalogs was when Dad wasn't around. Some weeks before, I had mailed a manuscript about comeback lines to Price Stern Sloan, a publisher in Los Angeles. I didn't know how they would feel about it, but I wasn't sitting around waiting for an answer. My attentions were focused on a new science fiction novel, which I entitled Sydney's Comet. It was about a society of overindulgence, a new angle on a previous unpublished novel I had written. In the new version, I was postulating a world that had no more room for garbage, nuclear wastes, or even the burial of human bodies. I'd been reading about a new technology of electromagnetic mass drivers, through which capsules of material might be launched from a planet into space. A wild scenario was forming in my mind as I envisioned all the garbage coming back at Earth like an avenging angel in a fiery garbage comet that threatened to wipe out the planet. In October, Chuck Gates of Price Stern Sloan called to say he wanted to publish my humor manuscript under the title Classic Comebacks. It was my first book sale. Dad told me he would look over the contract when it came in. We made arrangements to celebrate my book sale and his 59th birthday at the same time. He went on to say that we had other reasons for celebration. Mom had received a checkup which produced good news. Through her exercise program and diet, she had lost 10 pounds, while substantially increasing her heart and lung functions. They still weren't what they had been before the onset of cancer, and never would be. But Mom had survived the disease for more than 5 years, defying odds that were 95% against her. "She's a miracle cure," Dad said. "Thank God," I said. Dad said he always asked doctors for their first names, and afterward he refused to refer to them as doctor, using the first name instead. It prevented them from being condescending, he thought, and was a psychological method of making the doctors reveal medical details they might not otherwise tell a patient. "Call your doctor Jim," my father said. He thought this might be a good title for something, and I agreed it did have a certain ring to it. They left for Europe a week later. In London, they met Dino De Laurentiis and the new Dune director, Ridley Scott, whose suspense-filled science fiction horror movie Alien had recently been released. Scott said he liked 8 of the scenes from Dad's screenplay, and said that a number of new scenes would be needed. My parents returned to Port Townsend in mid-November. At long last, Dad was working non-stop on Sandworm of Dune, his working title for the long-awaited 4th book in the series. He was in an intense creative phase where he wouldn't answer letters with the exception of the most important until the project was complete. Chapter 25. Old Dreams, New Dreams. On the first Saturday in 1980, in the icy month of January, Jan and I delivered a case of Beaujolais Nouveau wine to Dad, having picked it up for him at a wine shop in Seattle. At dinner that evening, Dad said that he and Mom had decided to buy a vacation cottage in Hawaii to winter there, on one of the small outer islands along the 1,600-mile chain. "Something simple on the water," he said. "Bev can't stand the cold here in the winter." My mother's preference for warm weather had been mentioned before, especially since losing weight and the insulation of her fatty tissue. She kept saying she felt much better when the weather was warm. I was worried about the availability of medical services for her in remote regions, but said nothing of this, since the subject of her health was so uncomfortable to me. And inside I felt a gnawing terror of a different nature, a feeling I'd experienced on occasion that forces were at work trying to make me fly against my will. I hadn't flown in more than 10 years. Now it was a deep-seated fear ingrained in my psyche, and my parents were talking about living at least part of each year on a remote Pacific island. What if they decided to live there year-round? I asked if all the islands had electricity so that Dad could operate his electric typewriter and the custom computer he was having built, or if he intended to go back to using a small manual typewriter. He wasn't certain about the availability of electricity, but went on to talk about setting up solar panels and windmills to generate power, and maybe even a simple system of extracting hydrogen from seawater. It didn't sound very simple to me. On Monday, January 14th, 1980, Jan and I met my parents at Hugo's Rotisserie, a fine Seattle restaurant in the Hyatt House Hotel near SeaTac Airport. Both of them looked elegant and manicured. Mom in a beautiful new green blouse, one of her best colors, according to a color consultant, and Dad with his salt-and-pepper beard freshly trimmed. They were scheduled to fly to Hawaii the next morning to spend 2 weeks looking for property. Terrible storms had been ravaging the islands the past week, and Dad quipped, "This is always the best time to look at a piece of property, when it's at its worst." He had selected a rather unusual title for the computer book he was writing with Max Barnard, an idea that was indicative of my father's sense of humor. "Without me, you're nothing." This was Frank Herbert's philosophical comment about the secondary importance of the computer in relation to the human, and brought to mind the Butlerian jihad of Dune that opposed computers and certain other thinking machines, under the commandment, "Thou shalt not make a machine in the likeness of a human mind." The Hawaii-bound traveler seemed a little nervous. At the salad bar, Dad was passing out plates to all of us in line, and I guess he lost count, because he tried to hand one to a stranger. Later he knocked over my creme de menthe. Mom tried to rest her arms on a chair that had no armrests. They returned in 2 weeks. On the first Sunday in February, Dad delivered a speech at Tacoma Community College. He spoke to a packed auditorium about ecology and a wide variety of subjects, and told the audience about my first book sale. He was mobbed afterward by people wanting to talk with him. In a reversal of the usual roles they played, Mom drove him to Tacoma in her BMW. That evening, my parents told us they had made a $425,000 offer on a piece of unimproved Maui waterfront, 5 acres in the beautiful remote area of Hana. This was a region of cattle ranches and tropical jungle, separated from the more populated side of Maui by a 50-mile-long chuck-hole-infested stretch of the notorious Hana Highway, with more than 600 turns. Most of the locals did not want the road improved to keep developers and tourists out. The narrow route ran along cliff faces with sheer drop-offs to the ocean hundreds of feet below, crossing more than 50 bridges and many waterfalls. The property owner had been asking for $550,000, but the piece had been on the market a while, and the realtor thought they were making a good offer. "I always dicker," Dad said, a carryover from the times we lived in Mexico in the 1950s. He went on to say that the property was too nice for a simple cottage. They had decided to live in Hawaii full-time and sell their Port Townsend home. The words I hadn't wanted to hear. But the place sounded incredible. As we sipped my mother's favorite Puligny Montrachet wine, we talked about selling our Mercer Island home and moving to Hawaii ourselves, and about the education available there for Julie and Kim. Maybe Bruce and Penny and the rest of the family could move there too. Jan and Mom were ready to go even before the property deal closed. Dad said they had consulted a number of doctors, and with the impairment of Mom's lung capacity from radiation treatment, they were sure that a tropical climate would be more beneficial to her than the colder northwest weather. "My lungs feel clear when it's warm," she said. I showed Dad my new book contract on classic comebacks. He suggested several changes, including the addition of a clause stipulating Price Stern Sloan had to publish the book no later than October 31, 1981. Otherwise, he said, they could just hold on to the rights and delay publication indefinitely. He also had me cross off a sentence that enabled the publisher to copyright the book in their name, requiring instead that they copyright in my name. That gave me more control, he explained, and made it easier for me to go to a different publisher in the future if the book went out of print. They weren't paying in advance, and I would receive royalties based upon actual sales. But Dad said the contract wasn't bad for a first book. 2 weeks after our dinner, my parents announced that they had reached agreement to purchase the Hawaii land for $500,000, a substantial sum for that year and for the extremely remote location of the property. At my house, Dad unrolled a set of plans for the new house that they wanted to build. I researched old records, Mom said, and found a map showing our property. It's 5 miles from Hanatown, in an area that used to be called Ka'awaloa. That means a nice long time in Hawaiian. Isn't that nice? I think we'll spend a nice long time there. It's a magical place, unlike anything I've ever seen. I nodded, and thought how mysterious it all sounded. I studied the house plans, and a grand production it was, with a huge sunken living room and custom-made curved couches forming a conversation ring around a round coffee table, all looking out on the sea and the big island of Hawaii, with the volcano Mauna Kea visible. There would be a large writing wing for my father, with an extensive library adjacent, a wine cellar, and a dark room. A Japanese motif would be evident throughout, with shoji screens and artwork. Electricity would be generated with rooftop solar panels and a separate windmill structure. Botanical gardens would surround the home, with covered decks, a swimming pool, coconut and lauhala trees, stone walkways, lava walls, Polynesian sculptures, and a carp pond with a fountain. One area would be designated as a vegetable garden, and there would be a potting shed. Kawaloa was not only a perfect spot for Mom, he said, but an ideal place for him to hide from the legions of people clamoring to reach him. He'd gone to Port Townsend in 1973 for much the same reason, with fame pursuing him. But now he was far more famous, and as before, too many people knew where he lived. He had millions of fans, and many of them had placed him on a godlike pedestal, a myth status that troubled my father. They said they were listing the Port Townsend house for sale soon. I felt energy and excitement around them, from the changes they were setting in motion. It was romantic, charming, and heartwarming, with joy and sadness intermingled. They were often a South Seas adventure such as my father might have written, or perhaps my mother, given the inclination. In large part, of course, he was repaying Mom for the sacrifices she had made for him when she gave up her own promising career as a creative writer in order to work and support him while he wrote. Despite this and their excitement, I was deeply troubled. With my fear of flying, their move to an island in the Pacific would effectively isolate them from me. Unfortunately, this was occurring not long after I had become close to my complex, enigmatic father, after I had begun to understand him better.
In Port Townsend in early March 1980, Mom and Dad showed us revised plans of their Hawaii dream house and color slides Dad had taken of the land and the nearby Hawaiian scenery.
The property was situated at the edge of a lush tropical jungle, and there were breathtaking vistas of aquamarine water framed in black lava along the island shores. Many Hollywood personalities owned property at Hana, including Carol Burnett, Richard Pryor, Jim Nabors, George Harrison, and Bill Dana, Jose Jimenez. Hana was also the secluded paradise where aviator Charles Lindbergh chose to spend the last days of his life, when he knew he was dying. Lindbergh, a man obsessed with privacy since the tragic kidnapping and murder of his baby son, owned a beautiful, isolated piece of property several miles past my parents' place, toward Kaupo Gap. During his final days, he needed to stay close to medical personnel and rented a small house at Pu'uiki between Hanatown and Kawaloa. There, he worked on his memoirs. So my father was not the first famous person to seek refuge from fame in the Hana area. But this, of course, was not his primary purpose in going there. Later that month, Dad opened a bottle of 1973 Piper Heidsieck champagne with us and toasted Victor Temkin, the Berkeley Publishing Company president who had been instrumental in paying Dad a huge advance for Dune 4, Sandworm of Dune. Dad said it was a package deal with a future non-Dune science fiction book and said he had to work fast. Victor's nervous about paying all that money up front. During our second bottle of champagne, a Tattinger, I told him Sandworm of Dune sounded Aussie, and he said he'd been told by publishers and editors that he had an Oz situation in hand, where the reading public was clamoring for the next book before it was written. He had plans for even more Dune novels in the works. This book sale made it possible for them to begin construction on the Hawaii house without first selling the Port Townsend place. By the spring of 1980, construction of a caretaker's house at Kawaloa was underway on the upper side of the property, which sloped down from the Hana Highway toward the sea. This was phase one.
Under the next phase, to be begun later that year, they would live in the caretaker's house while the main house was built a little lower on the land, but still well away from the water.
Each time we got together with my parents, I recorded the events of our lives in my journal and committed to paper a plethora of details they were relating to me about their early years together, their childhoods, and our ancestors. This chronicle was becoming a growing, living force, demanding my undivided attention. I became obsessed with it, and before retiring to bed in the evening, I would scribble rough notes on odd sheets of paper for fleshing out when I had the time. The sooner I got it all written down, the better, I realized, when memories were fresh. As I lay in bed trying to fall asleep, the events of the day kept flowing through my mind, scrabbling to remain. I found myself unable to drift off until I had converted them to detailed notes. In a sense, I was becoming a prisoner of my journal, and in ensuing days when I was finally able to convert my notes to narrative, I felt wrung out. Oftentimes, this was as much from the emotion of the events as from the writing chore. But I was driven to keep up, fascinated by what I was learning about the esoteric world in which my parents lived, a world I shared at times and heard stories about at other times. I was intrigued by something else as well, by the insights my journal gave me to my inner being. It helped me to understand myself as I never had before. It became a tool for relieving stress and depression, for better analyzing situations, for removing the emotional component from decision-making and replacing it with reason. Written words, if carefully laid down, represented the civilized ideal of reason. They were instruments of analytical, organized thought. I told my journal my innermost secrets. It became a living entity, a comforting presence in times of need, someone to talk to who wouldn't laugh at me and wouldn't tell others what a fool I was. My journal did not begin at the beginning. It grew from the inside out. I had a love-hate relationship with it. On the morning of Sunday, March 2, 1980, I saw Mom in a long white robe, standing in the living room by the sliding glass doors on the west side of the house, gazing out at the duck pond. Sunlight glinted off the water, and she said, "It's beautiful here. I'm going to miss it." In the middle of April, Mom and Dad made a quick 4-day trip to Hawaii to check the progress of construction on the caretaker's house. They stayed in the elegant Hotel Hanamaui and met my brother Bruce there. Around that time, I sold a second humor book to Chuck Gates at Price Stern Sloan, a collection of authentic and bizarre insurance claims entitled Incredible Insurance Claims. The book would be published in late 1981 or early 1982, while my other book, Classic Comebacks, would be published in the spring of 1981. On April 26, 1980, a Saturday, we arrived in Port Townsend at 7:15 p.m. Dad barbecued filet mignon in the Kamado Japanese cooker and made an exquisite Caesar salad, served with a Clos Duval Cabernet Sauvignon. We celebrated my second book sale. They said they traded Mom's BMW and a Volkswagen that we had given to them for a small 1980 Mercedes coupe, which they were going to ship to Hawaii. Mom spoke again of her hopes for a boy Herbert baby to carry on the family name, and of her long-standing desire for Bruce to get married. She was losing hope that he ever would, and commented, "I'm afraid he's running with the boys from San Francisco." This was a suspicion only, and a reference to the gay community there, one of the most politically active in the world. I said nothing. Shortly after the eruption of Mount St. Helens in May 1980, we spent the weekend with my parents. At the conclusion of a Friday evening dinner, Dad said to me, "Let's talk story." Dutifully, I followed him up to his writing loft, carrying my Sidney's Comet manuscript in a gray and white box under my arm. He reviewed my work, which I hoped was now complete at almost 250 typed pages. He read and scanned rapidly, pausing occasionally to speak about certain sections, making numerous suggestions. As he spoke, I scribbled notes on sheets of newsprint. Since Dad worked in the newspaper business during many of the years when I grew up, newsprint was a common sight in our household. Many of Dad's manuscripts, typed on newsprint, bore further evidence of his journalism career. the number 30 on the bottom of the last page. This was a coded instruction from copy editors to typesetters, confirming that a news story had ended at that point. The following day, a Saturday, was drizzly in Port Townsend. In the living room, Dad and I worked on my novel. He said it was good through the first 100 pages, but after that, it lapsed too frequently into narrative, somewhat like an expanded outline. He thought I should expand the book, fleshing out many of the narrative passages into action and conflict among the characters. Just past lunch, an architect brought the Hanna house plans over and we reviewed them. They were for the main house, not yet under construction. Dad wanted to change the graceful shape of the living room, but Mom and Jan convinced him otherwise. When the architect left, we continued the writing session and Dad spoke about plot, the importance of keeping a story rolling so that the reader wants to turn the next page. Then he took me upstairs to his writing loft and went over 200 pages of Sandworm of Dune with me in detail to show how a plot and suspense should be set up. Afterward, Jan and I treated Mom and Dad to dinner at Lido by the Sea, a restaurant near the city marina. I was rather depressed after the writing session. After so much work on my book, I thought it was close to being done. It would take me 3 days to recover, during which time I didn't work on the manuscript at all. Then, determined, I set to work on it again, in every spare moment of time I had. Chapter 26. The Apprenticeship of Number One Son. When my father began to discuss my writing with me, he took great pains to say that no one could teach another person how to write. It was a craft best learned in the performance, he said, by placing the seat of one's pants on a chair for long periods of time with some sort of writing instrument before him. It wasn't as glamorous a profession as people believed. A writer was similar to a carpenter in his estimation. They were just different jobs. The writer even had a toolbox, except his was full of words. A carpenter carps, and an author auths, he quipped. He thought he might counsel me, working with my basic writing style to make it more clear, more organized, and then he intended to get out of my way. I can't write for you, he said. You must put in the long hours yourself. Frank Herbert could write at tremendous speed. Hellstrom's Hive, an 85,000-word novel, was written in 7 weeks, and during that period he corrected 2 sets of proofs on other novels of his that were about to be published. On one of his Dune sequels, he produced 600 single-spaced pages of scenes, notes, and characterizations in just a month and a half. He let it flow, overwriting, knowing he would cut the material way back later. To produce a 100,000-word novel, he said he often wrote 200,000 words. Once when I said I was going to leave some items out of a story, saving them for another work, my father shook his head and cautioned, "Never hold anything back. Put it all into your story. Don't worry that you won't have enough left for next time. It'll be there when you need it." The time he spent writing was not always productive. He recalled staying up into the wee hours one night working on a novel, writing what he thought at the time was some of the best material he had ever produced. But when he looked at it the next day, it was so bad he had to throw it all away. Dad didn't talk about his secret worlds while they were in development, except to my mother and occasionally to other members of the family. This was a piece of advice given to him in the 1950s by the noted Western writer Tommy Thompson, the favorite author of President Eisenhower. "Save your energy for putting words on paper," Thompson counseled. "You use the same energies talking about a story as you use writing it." He said young writers often talked their stories to death and never actually wrote them. My father took this advice to heart, and as he adopted it, he rather enjoyed playing a little game with anyone questioning him, rarely letting out the secrets he was conjuring until they were printed. His conservation of energy was an interesting example of the man, almost mirroring a facet of his most famous story, Dune. In his writing, he conserved energy as if it were precious water in the desert. This technique was also an effective psychological ploy used by the writer on himself, as the energies of his story became pent up, needing release. Ultimately, ideas exploded through his fingertips, to the typing keys, to the page. Frank Herbert believed his creative processes were partly in his fingers, the result of natural processes enhanced by years of training at a typing keyboard. He described it as a kinesthetic link, in which thoughts flowed from his brain through his body to his fingers and onto the paper. He tapped into something in that process, a powerful creative vein, and stories emerged. Some of his favorite ideas came from examining what he called our dearly beloved assumptions. One set of assumptions, found in the George X. McKee stories, the Dosadi Experiment, Whipping Star, and other tales, was that big centralized government structures helped people cope with rapidly growing, bewildering technology, and that justice could always be achieved through perfected systems of laws. His fervent political views provided an endless source of story ideas. He was particularly intrigued by the myths in which we live, by the unconscious assumptions we make regularly, assumptions that cause us to behave in predictable ways. In Children of Dune, he wrote, "These are illusions of popular history, which a successful religion must promote. Evil men never prosper. Only the brave deserve the fair. Honesty is the best policy. Actions speak louder than words. Virtue always triumphs. A good deed is its own reward. Any bad human can be reformed. Religious talismans protect one from demon possession. Only females understand the ancient mysteries. The rich are doomed to unhappiness. Myths are not always old," he taught. "Mankind is constantly in the process of creating its own. The Camelot of John F. Kennedy was the myth of a better society, in which leisure was king and everything man could desire was obtained effortlessly. It was linked with the long-familiar, ever-recurring myth of a heroic young leader, fulfilled in the minds of millions of Americans by the youthful President Kennedy." Other story ideas of my father's were extrapolations of present world conditions, a common source for science fiction writers. In the industry, the process is known as what if. What if a new form of humans could be created, whose members could pass unnoticed in our society? Hellstrom's Hive. What if mankind could travel instantaneously from one side of the universe to the other? Whipping Star, Man of Two Worlds, Dune. What if women dominated a political and or religious hierarchy? The Godmakers, Dune. The setting of Dune was my father's best-known extrapolation, in which a historical pattern of desert encroachment upon arable land was taken to the extreme, creating a world entirely covered by sand. In his 1959 short story, Missing Link, which later became part of The Godmakers, he described Planet Buster bombs, which were an extrapolation of City Buster atomic weapons then available. In The Dragon in the Sea, historical oil shortages were extrapolated, and he postulated technology that might exist in a world where oil was far more precious than it was today. There are many themes in the stories of Frank Herbert. Frequently he wrote about politics, religion, philosophy, water and water worlds, ecology, machines, genetics, and myths. I found a number of sub-themes or motifs particularly interesting as well, since he employed them as plot vehicles. He went to the well many times with stories of investigators traveling to far-off lands or strange places to unravel mysterious events, not unlike an investigative reporter going out to do a story. His variations were highly creative and interesting, and show how he successfully accomplished the Ezra Pound adage, "Make it new." Dad's first novel, The Dragon in the Sea, employs this motif. Ensign John Ramsey is assigned to the sub-tug Fenian Ram on a dangerous wartime mission to determine why crews on prior missions have not been able to endure psychological stresses. It is suspected that an enemy sleeper agent may be aboard as a saboteur, and it is Ramsey's duty to find out for certain. Perhaps my father's most memorable use of the investigator technique in a novel occurred in the Santa Rosa Barrier. A supermarket chain has not been successful in expanding to the insular town of Santa Rosa, and sends a university psychologist, Gilbert Design, to find out why. Prior investigators sent to the town have met with unfortunate accidents. Design becomes immersed in the affairs of the town and comes to empathize with the reasons the townspeople don't want his company's supermarkets. Still, he feels a strong obligation to his employer, and thus we have the seeds of conflict within the protagonist. In The Godmakers, a galactic empire is trying to reassemble itself after a series of terrible rim wars. The story's protagonist, Lewis Orne, is charged with investigating various planets to ensure that all is peaceful and that no seeds of warfare are germinating anywhere. One of his investigative missions, the climactic one, involves a trip he must take for his own sake to the priest planet of Amel. Hellstrom's hive concerns a mysterious underground hive of humans that is being investigated by a government agent. The hive, it turns out, is secretly a staging ground for humans who were adapting insect methods to improve the odds of survival of the species. An earlier agent has disappeared on this dangerous assignment. In the Dosadi experiment, George X. McKee is sent to investigate a secret psychological experiment in which the population of an entire planet is confined, an experiment that threatens to harm the whole galaxy. Other Frank Herbert short stories and novels involve the investigator motif, sometimes involving colonization, exploration, and experiments away from Earth, all used as plot vehicles. In Destination Void, scientists are trying to develop an artificial intelligence, but due to failures and deaths in prior experiments, they plan to perform future experiments away from Earth, on the distant planet Tau Ceti. The experiments are highly secret and are concealed in an apparent colonization mission to Tau Ceti. The colonization plot is closely allied with another recurring motif in my father's work, survival and adaptation to difficult circumstances. This is the subject of his early short stories, Survival of the Cunning and The Jonah and the Jap, as well as of the novel Dune, where the planet is covered with sand and the most precious commodities are water and a mysterious spice drug melange found only on Dune. Expressing his philosophy about the necessity for adaptation, Dad wrote that this drug is like life. It presents a different face each time you take it. In The Dragon in the Sea, Captain Sparrow's definition of sanity is the ability to swim. The sane person has to understand currents, has to know what's required in different waters. Insanity is something like drowning. You go under, you flounder without direction. In Dune, this variation appears as a Bene Gesserit axiom. Survival is the ability to swim in strange water. Hellstrom's Hive is about species adaptation and survival, about whether mankind might survive longer on Earth by utilizing insect methods. In Destination Void, a complex ship's computer, organic mental core, fails entirely while the ship is in deep space, stranding 3,000 passengers. To avoid certain death, the occupants must come up with a method of performing mind-boggling calculations previously done by the computer. There are inhospitable planets in a number of stories, where characters must adapt to new and dangerous conditions. These include the desert planet Arrakis, Dune, of the Dune series, the water world Pandora of the Jesus Incident and two sequels, and the overcrowded war-torn world Dosadi of the Dosadi experiment. He wrote often of beings with godlike powers, entities that took on differing forms. In God Emperor of Dune, the entity was part sandworm, part human, with a Frank Herbert-like mind containing a vast storehouse of knowledge. In Destination Void and the Jesus Incident, the entity was a supercomputer. In Whipping Star, it was a celestial body, a star. In The Godmakers and Dune, the gods were in human form. Sometimes story ideas came to my father in dreams, or as he lay in bed half awake. These would be scribbled on a notepad by his bed. He called them his dream notes. One night, he came up with the most remarkable story idea of his entire life, even better than Dune. Upon awaking in darkness, he flipped on the lamp by his bed and scribbled the story idea down, intending to work on it the following day. When he awoke the next morning, he read the notepad. It said only, "Great idea for a story." When I began writing novels, my father told me rather ominously that editors made decisions about stories based upon the first three pages. If you don't hook them by that time, they'll probably toss it. A powerful narrative hook is essential in the beginning of the story, he said. Sometimes Dad placed his narrative hook in an epigram preceding the text of the story, and sometimes it was enmeshed into the early action of the tale. But always it was there. He taught me how to ground a reader quickly and solidly, much in the fashion of a newspaper story, and how to coax the reader to delve further into the tale. As with so many facets of writing, it was a balancing act, he said, as the writer doesn't want to overwhelm his reader with too much information too soon, like turning on a fire hose. Dad liked to end scenes and chapters on a note of suspense, and did this to keep the reader turning the pages, to maintain his interest. This was Frank Herbert's definition of plot, stringing words together to make a reader want to read the next line. He put his characters under mounting tension in a story, pressure situations where they had to improvise and adapt in order to survive. Mirroring real life, his story people were constantly presented with surprise situations, wild card events. In Destination Void, each leading character had what he called a dominant psychological role to perform, based upon Jungian archetypes. This squared the characters off against one another, and made the predicaments in which they were placed more challenging and suspenseful than they might normally have been. After examining one of my early attempts at novel writing, Dad looked at me and said, "I can't see what you're trying to describe. It's not coming alive for me." The answer lay in providing more details, he said, but only the right kind of details. During a writing session on Sidney's Comet, he was wading through a number of my passages in which I described characters getting up, sitting down, walking around, moving their heads, and the like. "Too much business here," he said, using a ballpoint pen to line things out. Another time he said, "Cut, cut, and cut again." While working on Sidney's Comet, I had a scene that wasn't going anywhere, and I telephoned Dad to ask for advice. After describing the situation to him, he said I had a plot problem, and that I should go back and examine closely the motivations of my characters. "That's how I always free a story," he said. I tried it, and to my excitement, it worked. Another time I was having trouble making my dialogue sound realistic. Dad said it would help me to listen in on conversations in restaurants and other public places. "I've always been a shameless eavesdropper," he confided, a phrase that he repeated at writing workshops. He also suggested that writers speak their dialogue aloud to make it flow more smoothly. My father taught me a great deal about his craft, and sometimes, as I write now, many years after our earliest and most basic writing sessions, I hear him speaking to me, counseling me in ways that I might improve my work. Chapter 27. We used to visit them all the time. At Xanadu in July of 1980, Dad sat in the living room with Jan and me, drinking coffee and talking about art. Jan had recently been accepted into the interior design program at the prestigious Cornish Institute in Seattle, and I had just received my second book contract for incredible insurance claims. He said if I kept working at it, I would eventually be a published novelist. "Now that you're both getting into artistic endeavors," my father said, "you'll experience more exaggerated highs and lows than most people have. You'll need to lean on one another for support during the low times, and when you succeed, the good times will be all the sweeter." He gave us other advice, and said that Jan and I would become best friends through an understanding of one another's work. Then he looked over at Mom, who was needlepointing a pillow. "There's my best friend," he said. Director Ridley Scott was in the early production phases on the Dune movie, operating from an office at Pinewood Studios in London. He had retained the services of the noted production designer H.R. Giger, who had worked with him on the 1979 science fiction film Alien, to make drawings and storyboards. Scott had also conducted an exhaustive search for a screenplay writer capable of handling Dune, and after many interviews had settled upon Rudolf Wurlitzer. Other movie people were interested in Soulcatcher, with two rival groups looking at the screenplay. One production company was headed by Robert Redford, the other by Marlon Brando and Henry Fonda. Dad expected a call at any moment from Redford. My mother and I stayed up talking that evening after Dad went to bed, and she told me that Hana, the town nearest their new home, was named after a Japanese word for flower. A very spiritual place, it was inhabited by native Hawaiians who seemed locked into a bygone time, with a slower, less hectic pace of life. I understood this, but expressed a great deal of sadness to her about the move. The following day, Dad called me at home. He said he'd been talking with Mom, and they had decided to keep the Port Townsend house now, with the place at Kaualoa and a third home, an apartment in Paris or London. In ensuing weeks, Robert Redford called my father to ask about acquiring the option to film Soulcatcher. Dad referred him to Ned Brown in Beverly Hills, his movie agent. "Redford is the buyer," my father said, "and I make it a practice never to negotiate directly with buyers. That's what I hire agents for." On a Saturday later that month, Jan and I pulled onto the gravel driveway in front of my parents' house at shortly before 6 p.m. The children were not with us. I noticed an ominous presence on one side of the parking area. a large trans-ocean shipping container. From telephone conversations, I knew it was almost full and would be packed up in a few days. In the house later that evening, we spoke of many things. I noticed the final draft of Sandworm of Dune opened to page 516 beside my mother's chair, near the conclusion of the just-completed manuscript. Dad said it was a totally new type of love story, unlike anything ever written before. Just before 10 o'clock, Dad bid us good night at his usual time, so that he could rise early the next morning and write. He kissed Mom and whispered something in her ear, which caused her to smile. As he shuffled off to bed, he yawned, simultaneously making a drawn-out mid-range tone that was punctuated with a high-pitched yow at the end. He entered the master bedroom and closed the door behind him. On Sunday morning, Jan and I were intending to leave after breakfast because of long ferry lines in the summer. The worst times were Sunday evenings, when many people returned to Seattle from weekends on the Olympic Peninsula. When I got up, Jan told me she'd been out on the deck with my parents, looking over the pond and the trees, and Dad said he wanted us to stay for dinner. It might be our last moments together in Xanadu for a long time. We told them we would stay, and my father generously set out a very special bottle of 1970 Chateau Mouton Baron Philippe Pauillac, a Bordeaux red. Robert Redford would be in Port Townsend on July 21st, Dad said, for a very secret meeting with him. He didn't elaborate and seemed hesitant to discuss whatever was in the wind. I only knew it had something to do with the potential Soul Catcher movie. Dad had just reached agreement with Berkeley Books for a huge advance on the paperback rights for the fifth Dune book, to be entitled Heretics of Dune. It was scheduled for completion in 1981. The title of the fourth, soon-to-be-released book was now God Emperor of Dune instead of Sandworm of Dune. Under the terms of the Heretics sale, payments were to be stretched over a number of years. Mom was feeling the financial pinch of everything they were trying to do, and she mentioned a much-needed royalty check that arrived ahead of its due date in recent days for French sales of Dune. "Just when we need money, it seems to arrive," she said. It was a warm day, and we all went swimming in the pool. Mom did two-thirds of a lap underwater, while Dad remained alert, ready to help her at any moment. When it was nearly time for dinner, he got the Kamado, a Japanese barbecue, going, and cooked steaks, which we enjoyed with a Pauillac wine at a picnic table on the patio. Dad told a funny story about two Irishmen who met two Mexican girls in Scandinavia. Then he asked me how I was coming on the rewrite of Sidney's Comet. I told him I was around 190 pages into it, and I didn't think I could complete it before they left for Hawaii later in the month. "Use the mails," he said. "Maybe you can send it to Lurton Blessingame after I look it over. He's still active and involved with young writers." The ferry lines were terrible that evening, and it took us 5 hours to get home. By late August 1980, the first draft of the Dune screenplay written by Rudolf Wurlitzer was in front of my father. Dad was not at all pleased with it and said Wurlitzer had oversimplified the story, almost turning it into a juvenile. Too many key scenes were missing, he said. It rubbed him, too, that the screenplay omitted Dune's balisette, the stringed instrument used by Gurney Halleck, the troubadour warrior. My father wanted the film to be the first to introduce an entirely new musical instrument. Two more drafts would follow. Just before their departure for Hawaii, my parents visited us at our Mercer Island home. They mentioned two going-away parties given for them recently in Port Townsend, one a highbrow affair at the farmhouse restaurant and the other a chili feed at a friend's house. It amused Mom to have close friends on both ends of the social scale, from gourmets to chili eaters. Dad said that the computer book written with Max Barnard, Without Me, You're Nothing, was essentially complete, just one of many projects he had taken care of before leaving Port Townsend. "I've been running around like a chicken with my head cut off," he said. My parents kept changing their minds about whether or not they would sell Xanadu, the Port Townsend house. Initially, it was to be 6 months in Xanadu and 6 in Kawaloa. A short while later, they thought full-time in Hawaii might be better. Then, when Dune series royalties and a big movie advance poured in, they came up with a three-residence idea: Hawaii, Port Townsend, and London or Paris. Now they told us they had changed their minds once more and decided to sell the Port Townsend house after all. This was a blow to me, though I couldn't say it was entirely unexpected. It made the move seem so final. Dad also said the Caladan, only a year old, wouldn't be a suitable sailboat for Hawaii, with its fin keel and large expanses of glass. Consequently, he was listing it for sale with a Seattle yacht broker. Mom was pretty worried about whether we were going to be able to visit them in Hawaii, since I couldn't fly, and she emphasized how much she wanted us to live there. She checked with 3 cruise ship lines about trips between the mainland and Hawaii, and found that all were either unsafe or no longer operating. Dad gave me a floppy Hawaiian hat, and with misty eyes, said he wanted us to get together for Christmas in Hawaii, maybe around January 6th. That was Twelfth Night, the date we had celebrated Christmas several times in my childhood. I reminded him I couldn't fly. "You'll have to bite the bullet and do it," he said. And he spoke of how safe flying in Hawaii was, how Royal Hawaiian Air Service, which flew between the islands, had never experienced a fatal accident. My mother spoke of the beauty of Hawaii, made more breathtaking when seen from the air. She described Royal Hawaiian flights over cliff faces with waterfalls pouring down them, vast stretches of water between the islands, and spectacular sunrises. Hana Airport was a swath of runway at the edge of a jungle. A week went by before I was able to continue my journal entries, since I was too upset to write. I finally made the entries on Sunday, September 6th, while we sat in the car in yet another ferry line. This time, Jan, the kids, and I were coming back from the Port Townsend house. We had picked up some vegetables and a couple of boxes of canned goods my mother and father had left for us. We slept in the house Saturday in sleeping bags. Xanadu was not entirely empty, but may as well have been for the lack of life in it. They left some basic furniture groupings in the main rooms so that it would look better for realtors to show to buyers. They also arranged for a caretaker for the property, a friend named Doug Sandow, and while we were there, he was getting moved into the apartment downstairs. He slept on a mattress on the floor during our visit. Nice fellow, and conscientious about details. All the wonderful dune paintings that had been on the south wall of the living room were gone, having been placed in storage. They were in a top-secret facility on Elliott Avenue West in Seattle, an unobtrusive, rather run-down-appearing building with no sign, used by local art museums to house the works of renowned painters. Dad's loft study was almost bare, except for an electric typewriter, so that he could write if he came back to visit before the property was sold. The pool was drained. Xanadu seemed so dark and cold. It was still special in and of itself, but it was the people who had illuminated it. I couldn't hold back the tears. Jan wanted to see the wine room, where Dad and I had always gone to make the wine selections. It was empty, except for a few bottles of ordinary wine. Saturday night we ate at the Sea Galley restaurant on the bay in Port Townsend, and had to wait more than an hour for a table because crowds were in town to visit Port Townsend's 3rd annual wooden boat show. When the public address system announced, "Herbert, table of 4," many people we didn't know turned their heads to look at us. We left early Sunday morning because it was too difficult remaining in the empty house. Cartoons and notes were still on the kitchen bulletin board, and there was a note under the door from a couple who visited on August 31st, unaware my parents had flown to Hawaii 2 days before that. As we rode the ferry across Hood Canal that Sunday morning, I looked east at the half-missing Hood Canal floating bridge. When that was closed by a storm in February 1979, it hastened my parents' feeling of isolation in Port Townsend. Thereafter, a 3-to-5-hour multiple ferry and driving trip to Seattle was required, twice the normal length of time. Julie piped up from the back seat, "I want to see Nana and Grandpa again. We used to visit them all the time." And Kim said, "When I go to Hawaii, I'm going to wear my mula." She meant muumuu dress. "Julie, are you going to wear Nana's mula dress that she gave you? She'd like that." Julie drew very quiet. A week later, I spoke with my parents by telephone and learned they were living in a rented house midway between Hana Town and their property, and would stay there until January, when the contractors expected to complete their 2,400-square-foot caretaker's house. The plan was that they would move into the caretaker's house, and from there supervise construction of the main house. Dad said his new Mercedes coupe wasn't working out in Hana because of extremely rough road conditions. Each day they had to drive over ruts, potholes and washboard areas that would probably never be repaired, since the locals liked the road that way. He wished he had brought a four-wheel drive Jeep instead, and asked if I could locate a new one for him and have it shipped. I agreed to do so. The worst bumps and sections of road around Hana had names for them, and he spoke of the most notorious stretch of roadway, known as the Molokai Washboard, which had a surface like an old washboard. It was between his house and town. "It'll shake your eyeballs out," he said. On the 1st of October, I mailed my just-completed 300-page manuscript of Sydney's Comet to Dad with this note. "I'm very tired, but I have a feeling I'm not finished yet. It seems there's no end to pages that need correcting." Later that month, my father returned the manuscript with a note written on a yellow sheet of paper that had been wrinkled by typing strikes from other sheets on top of it. I recognized this as a sheet placed beneath another to prevent striking the platen too hard, thus avoiding indentations on the platen. His note said, "These pages, 22 to 27, show how editing tightens the story. Go now and do likewise." Frank Herbert, while not formally religious, knew Scripture. In Luke 10:37 of the New Testament, Jesus told his followers the story of the Good Samaritan, and then said, "Go, and do thou likewise." These six pages were closely edited, while others had fewer notations on them. I spoke with Mom shortly before the November 1980 presidential election. She said that she and Dad had been arguing about politics, since she held a high opinion of Ronald Reagan, while Dad loathed him. Recently, my father had purchased what he called a voice stress analyzer, a little handheld device that, when activated, could supposedly tell when a person was lying. He had been pointing it at the television during Reagan's speeches, and periodically Dad would exclaim, "Reagan's lying again! Bev, come in here and look at this meter!" A while later, Mom wrote to me on her new stationery, with Kawaloa printed on it in large letters beside a drawing of the house. While my parents were in Hawaii, the Dune movie project came unraveled again. As Harlan Ellison reported in the June 1985 issue of Fantasy and Science Fiction, the third draft of Rudolf Wurlitzer's screenplay included an incestuous relationship between Paul and Jessica. As Ellison put it, "Have you ever heard Frank Herbert bellow with rage?" I heard it on a number of occasions, including this one. Dad said that he wasn't interested in any variation of his theme, including one in which Aaliyah, Paul's sister, as Dad wrote Dune, becomes his daughter as well. Appalled, Frank Herbert told Dino De Laurentiis that Dune fans would never tolerate an incestuous relationship between their beloved characters, and De Laurentiis agreed. To make matters worse, director Ridley Scott, who had spent months in the early stages of production, now had to leave for another film he was under contract to direct, Blade Runner. Once again, the long-awaited film version of the greatest science fiction novel of all time, Dune, had no director and no screenplay. In mid-December, I mailed a satirical science fiction short story to my father for his opinion, called Earth Games. It was about an alien world where Earth people were kept prisoner and forced to perform games with hot rod automobiles. These games strongly resembled rush hour commute times in any major city, when drivers competed for lane space and made unfriendly gestures at one another. A slight difference: these cars had machine guns on the fenders and cannons on the rooftops. As before, I could not telephone my parents before noon, since Dad wrote in the mornings. Now I had to calculate the difference in time zones, since it was 3 hours earlier in Hawaii than in Seattle. During phone conversations with my mother, at all hours of the afternoon or evening, she invariably said Dad was writing in another room, and she could hear the rapid machine rhythm of his electric typewriter. This time, however, I heard Dad playing his harmonica in the background, a happy sound I hadn't heard in a long while. She said Dad was setting aside the custom computer system he had been designing and building with Max Barnard. The technology was changing too rapidly, Dad thought, and he was considering the purchase of a stock computer and printer. He planned to study available systems upon returning to the mainland. In those conversations across the Pacific, I realized how much the Hana area reminded my parents of rural Mexico. They described tropical, verdant colors and the relaxed work ethic of the dark-skinned natives, in which tasks were often put off for another day. and I realized something else as well. My father, a most imperfect man, had done an absolutely perfect thing for the woman he loved. The construction he undertook at Kawaloa was his gallant effort to save her life, or at the very least, to make what remained of it pleasurable. Book 3, Kawaloa. Chapter 28, First Class. From this cup I drank as deeply as any man should do, and was sated with it. T. E. Lawrence. In mid-January 1981, Dad and Mom called, one on each line from Kawaloa. Because of the underwater telephone cable between Hawaii and the mainland, their voices sounded as if they were coming from the insides of coffee cans, and I heard static.
They spoke sadly of my first cousin Matt Larson and a hiking companion, who had lost their lives on Mount Adams in Oregon that winter.
Recently, my parents had shipped their 80 Mercedes coupe to me from Hawaii for safekeeping. They wanted me to take care of a number of maintenance items on it. Several boxes were also being sent to us for babysitting, as my mother put it. They had packed the Transocean container hastily in Port Townsend and had things they would never use in the tropics, including tire chains, snowshoes, ski poles, wool-lined boots, and even a goodly amount of fishing equipment they couldn't use since fishing was done differently in Hawaii, using long poles or spear guns. Brass and metal items were coming back as well, including rifles, to protect them from the moist, corrosive salt air of Kawaloa. In addition, they were experiencing problems with some articles of wood furniture that were warping from moisture in the air. The Jeep I had shipped to them was running well, but was too drafty for Mom. They were thinking of trading it in on a more enclosed vehicle, such as a Chevrolet Blazer or Ford Bronco. Then they said something heartening. Xanadu had been listed for sale for several months without offers, largely because of a depressed economy in the area. They had decided not to sell the property after all. It would be one of their bases of operation, as my father put it. He had also decided to keep the sailboat Caladan. Judging from all of this, taking the wrong car and other things to Hawaii, as well as their indecision about keeping Xanadu and the sailboat, it was clear they were making decisions emotionally, without adequate planning. It made me wonder if my mother might be even more ill than they were letting on, if she had received bad medical news that we hadn't been told about yet. Everything they did was in a big rush, a desperate surging this way and that.
But every time I asked how Mom was feeling, she or my father said fine, or great, or much improved.
She had survived inoperable lung cancer since 1974. This was nothing less than a triumph of human spirit. She had fought the disease, refusing to succumb to it. My parents spoke of wanting a swimming pool for her at Kawaloa, so that she could resume her exercise regime. She missed the laps in the pool in Port Townsend. They were living in the caretaker's house, though it was not quite complete, and mentioned difficulties with the main house plans. Dad had obtained bids based upon his architect's drawings, and found construction would cost millions more than he wanted to spend. Beyond that, he felt the house was more suited to the Pacific Northwest, where the architect lived. In researching homes that were best suited to the Hana area, he contacted entertainers Jim Neighbors and Richard Pryor and a number of other locals, all of whom were kind enough to show my father through their homes. He determined that the best and most cost-effective dwelling to build was a pole house, where the structure sits up off the ground on a heavy piling foundation. The house would have a manually operated louver system in the walls, a feature that would permit outside air to circulate inside, cooling the home. In outward appearance, it would most resemble the neighbor's home. Dad drew up his own plans and had them transformed to blueprint form by a structural engineer. The site was on a hillside, which presented difficulties in making the home accessible to a heart patient. He tried to place most of the areas Mom needed to reach every day on one level, including the swimming pool, the main living areas, and the master bedroom. He didn't want her to have to climb stairs. Additionally, since Dad was acquainted with marine architecture, he would incorporate a number of boat features into the design. The main house had to go in before the pool could be begun. At first, Dad wanted to utilize wind power from constant trade winds to heat the pool, but he opted instead to heat it with solar panels. These panels would be factory-built and not the unique beer can variety he had designed for Port Townsend. While he was explaining this to me, something came up with the contractors and he had to leave the telephone. Mom stayed on and told me about Hannah. It was the most beautiful place she had ever seen. In ensuing weeks, we had numerous telephone conversations, discussing family business and personal matters that they wanted me to handle for them, and the other day-to-day activities of our lives. In one conversation, Mom said a neighbor gave a party and she won a Smithfield ham. As she spoke to me, she was gazing out upon three palm trees below the house and said a lovely warm breeze had been blowing all day. "I've been painting," she said. "Flowers, the sea, cattle in the fields. This is an artist's paradise. I only wish I had more talent." Early in the morning of April 11th, 1981, a Saturday, we brought boxes and packages of my parents' things to them in Port Townsend, stuff shipped back from Hawaii. A number of fishing poles were in aluminum tubes, and some of the boxes were quite heavy, being full of brass and steel items. The weather was brisk, in the 40s, but feeling colder from the wind. Mom and Dad looked tan but tired. They had been back only a few days and still hadn't adjusted to the change of climate. He had been trying to write, but didn't have the energy to go full steam. After lunch, my father and I played hearts at the dining room table, while Mom and Jan sat in the living room talking. "One thing was sent back here that should have remained in Hawaii," my mother said. "Me." She wore a heavy sweater and was curled up in a lounge chair with an orange and brown Afghan blanket over her. "Look outside," she said. Dad and I glanced up from our card game. Hail was coming down. She spoke about how much warmer it was at Kawalua, with warm trade winds blowing. They planned to return to Port Townsend a little later the following year, in May, staying through October or November. Dad needed 200 days of residency on the mainland because of extremely high state income taxes in Hawaii, yet another detail he had overlooked in the rush to move there. By spending that amount of time away from Hawaii, his income would not be taxed under Hawaiian law. They said the caretaker's house was finished on their property and was very comfortable. Ground was just being broken for the main house. We spoke of Penny, who was doing well. Then the matter of Bruce came up. My parents said he had revealed to them what they had long suspected, that he was a homosexual man. Furthermore, he was participating in ACT UP gay political marches and other events in San Francisco. Mom and Dad were not at all pleased by this information. On the heels of this, we told my parents exciting news. Jan was going to have a baby that fall. Suddenly, they were ecstatic. Dad took me to the wine cellar and located a special wine to celebrate the occasion, a Chateau Prieuré Lichin Margaux. Before anything else was done, we opened it and shared a toast to the newest Herbert. I helped Dad put a desk together in his study. Since his roll top was now in Hawaii, this was a makeshift plywood unit he had built himself. It was stained black, matching the color of the Port Townsend house trim. When we finished, he said the familiar and welcome, "Let's talk story." Dad went downstairs and brought back a cup of freshly brewed coffee for himself. I didn't want any, fearing I might tip it over in my nervousness. We were about to look at a novel I had labored over for many months. Sidney's Comet was now more than 350 pages long. After a couple of hours, Dad complimented me on my work, but said he felt I needed to get my main character, a handicapped government office worker named Sidney Malloy, more centrally involved in the story. I was given a signed hardcover copy of God Emperor of Dune, and my father said that in addition to his other writing projects, he was just beginning work on a sequel to The Jesus Incident with Bill Ransom. A substantial hardcover advance had been paid by Putnam for the new work. On a Saturday, 2 weeks later, Dad and I took the kids on a hike in the woods while Mom and Jan fixed dinner. On the trek, we were accompanied by a new addition to their household, a big gray and white cat who had a curious habit of running alongside us like a dog. It was a foundling they discovered upon returning from Hawaii, and Dad originally named it Catterwall for the commotion it made at night. They had it neutered to quiet it down and renamed it Baron, from Baron Vladimir Harkonnen of Dune. They also enjoyed a certain play on words with that name, a nice double entendre, actually, as the cat was now barren and unable to produce offspring. He was house-trained, and his only fault seemed to be that he nuzzled in from behind under his mistress's arm when she was trying to type. Mom had always been fond of cats. At dinner that evening, we learned that my parents had found caretakers for Kawaloa, who would eventually live in the separate residence that had already been built for them. They were a couple in their 30s. We had been offered the caretaker's position some months earlier and had turned it down because of the isolation of Hana. God Emperor of Dune had just been released in hardcover and was already a national bestseller. Even before publication, Putnam had been deluged with thousands of advance orders from bookstores anxious to carry it. "It's hot," Dad said. Special editions of the book had been run, 750 boxed and signed copies in addition to the regular printing, and Dad had a number of these stacked on a table in the lower-level library, where he was signing them. The hardcover volumes were black, with gold lettering on the spines, and would be sold by the publisher for $45 apiece. We talked at length about our family tree, and I took a lot of notes. Mom said she was proud of me for being so interested in chronicling our family, that we had a lot of interesting things going on that should not be forgotten. Afterward, Jan and my mother occupied themselves with projects in the living room, while Dad and I were in the loft study just above them, going over Sydney's Comet again, including the rewrites I had done since our last conversation. He said it was very close. It just needed one additional scene and some syntax modifications. My father praised my writing more than he ever had before. He said I had learned a great deal through hard work and persistence, that my plot was clever and well laid out, with good dialogue and narrative passages. He said I had written a first-rate satire and that it was something of a pastiche, a melding of motifs and techniques. On May Day, 1981, my mother called from Port Townsend and said something was happening on the Dune movie project again. I heard excitement in her voice. They had a number of meetings scheduled with movie people, and producer Dino De Laurentiis was getting a new director, breathing new life into the project. 3 days later, Dad left with Mom on a 13-day God Emperor of Dune book tour, with scheduled appearances in Seattle, San Francisco, Berkeley, Los Angeles, Chicago, New York, and Boston. On this and other book tours, my parents developed a routine. Arriving at the airport of a city, Mom would take a taxi to the hotel to register them, while Dad would go off in a taxi or limousine on promotional activities. She liked to bring along a portable Sony radio and miniature Sony television as well, to listen to Dad or watch him during interviews. Mom didn't want to miss anything, no matter where she was. She also made certain he had all of the books or promotional materials he needed for public appearances, and she coordinated his appointments, making certain he didn't miss one. During the hectic activities of a tour, with thousands of people clamoring for his attention, Dad relied heavily on Mom's organizational skills. Some of their days were filled with 20 to 24 hours of promotional activity, so they got pretty bleary-eyed, as Dad said. When his appearances involved speeches, she wrote promotional flyers and made up press kits, including news articles, photos, and other literature about Dad and his writings. She sent these to newspapers, magazines, radio stations, and television stations all over the country, a month or two ahead of Dad's appearances for speeches or autograph parties, to make certain that stories were run on him. That month, Dino De Laurentiis, now in concert with Universal Studios, announced a new director for the Dune project, 35-year-old David Lynch, director of the highly acclaimed films Eraserhead and The Elephant Man. An avid fan of the book, he would write the screenplay himself and promised a production that would be true to the author's original. Lynch's creative talents were not confined to writing and filmmaking. He was a painter, which excited my father for the special visual perspective this art form could bring to the story. Lynch had come a long way in a short period of time. Only 3 years before, he had produced and directed Eraserhead for around $30,000, a film that went on to become a cult classic. His budget for Dune was initially set at $30 million and would soon go much higher. In the midst of Frank Herbert's worldwide fame, his son-in-law, Ron Merritt, asked of him, "Frank, what do you want out of life?" The response, without equivocation, "First class." Dad was never made of patience, and with his success, he was required to travel more and more, on book tours, to conventions, to meet with agents and publishers. This took him away from his study, where he really wanted to be, creating new stories. He decided that if he couldn't write, he would demand the best services while he was on the road. In part, this was from having experienced the finest hotels and restaurants in the world, so he was using them as standards of comparison. But increasingly, he came to demand excellence for the sake of my mother's comfort and for her dietary requirements. He was extremely protective of her and attentive to her needs. Thursday, May 28, 1981, was a beautiful 70-degree day in Seattle, with blue skies and lazy drifting clouds. My father had been on a local television show for half an hour the previous evening. This morning he was on the Today Show, taped earlier and broadcast nationally from New York. At the office of Stanley T. Scott and Company, the insurance agency where I worked, we watched him on the lunchroom television set. Later in the morning, Dad was interviewed by a Seattle radio station. The radio interview concluded at noon, after which my celebrity father was driven by limousine to a downtown delicatessen for a sandwich. Then he hurried to afternoon autograph parties at two Seattle bookstores, lasting until 5:30 p.m. We made arrangements to meet at a restaurant that evening. At dinner, Dad was a bit demanding, which he had a tendency to be at restaurants when he was hungry. Initially, we were seated at a table where surrounding conversation was too noisy for us to converse comfortably. Dad went to the maitre d' and demanded another table, which he received, but only after telling the maitre d', "This is a disgusting way to treat a regular customer." On other occasions, Dad would stand at the front counter waiting for a table, positioning himself so that he interfered with the normal flow of patrons and employees. In this manner, he was able to get seated sooner, as the restaurant wanted to get him out of the way. It was a trick he had learned from another science fiction writer. Once we had our table, Dad was in fine form. He told such an amazing array of interesting stories and jokes that people at nearby tables were eavesdropping, even laughing at Dad's punchlines. Howie Hansen and his new wife Joanne were with us this evening, and on one occasion Howie said something about computers. Dad disagreed with the comment and became very authoritative. It was characteristic of my father that he never admitted he was wrong about anything. He was super knowledgeable, as my mother put it. Everything he said came out as if it was supported by the entire research facility of the Encyclopedia Britannica. This evening, I found it all very amusing. Dad filled us in for several minutes on God Emperor of Dune. It was number 4 on the New York Times bestseller list for hardcovers, number 1 on other lists, and even hotter than his biggest previous bestseller, Children of Dune. Berkeley Books would come out with the paperback after the hardcover had run its course at around 200,000 copies, with 1 million first-edition paperback copies planned. He gave me a colorful stand-up cardboard cutout with a spaceship on it, bearing the words,